Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Friend Rap Show. I'm going to be your host today. My name is Makoni, and I'm joined by one of the finest gentlemen at the Institute, Terence Corrigan. Unfortunately, Nicholas is ill-disposed, so I'm going to be doing the hosting job and the behind-the-scenes job. So if there are any technical issues that seem to be out of whack, please forgive me. I'm trying to man both the behind and the front scenes. But to give you a brief summary of the stories we'll be covering today, we have the Palestinian refugee flight that was chartered and landed in South Africa on Friday, 14th November. I think Terence has some very interesting things to say about that. We'll also be covering the exemption to South African oranges that, according to Business Life, have regained edge in the US markets after the tariff cut. And we will conclude with the South African Municipal Workers Union holding the Johannesburg municipality, well, let's say at gunpoint, with threats of protests if they fail to give them the wage increases that they believe they are due. And the city of Johannesburg will do anything to save itself from international embarrassment. Embarrassment from us as people who live there, not so much. But foreigners and dignitaries arriving in South Africa, that's too big of a scandal for them. But let's start with the first story here. It is reported by City Press and is titled The Israeli Links Behind Palestinian Refugee Flights. The story jumps right in and it reads, the two charter flights that brought Palestinian refugees to South Africa over the past month may just be the tip of the iceberg. And these are the flights of the 20th and the 28th of October. City Press sister publication report has learned that the South African aviation operators had already received requests for a dozen such flights as far back as August. The latest flight to arrive Friday, 14th November, at the OR International OR Tambo International Airport in the past week, with 153 refugees on board, was said to be arranged by a dubious humanitarian aid organization named Al Majid. The flights are believed, and this is where the Israeli links come, to be linked to Israel's plan, City Press alleges, to remove as many Palestinians as possible from the Gaza Strip to other countries under so-called voluntary migration. Last week's flights were initially intended to arrive during the G20 summit in South Africa, while South Africa's on international stage and it's being watched by large number of officials as a large number of countries, as these all these officials from these countries are arriving at the summit. And it was apparently intended to leave the authorities with no choice but to accommodate the group. It is said that this last week, Friday's group of refugees, as well as the previous group that arrived quietly on October 20th, were arrived by the same intermediaries. Both flights were coordinated from Nairobi by KTN Air International, which is headquartered in Tel Aviv. And this company is not responding to inquiries. Neither is the company Al Majid, which supposedly arranged and booked all these flights. This Al Majid company is apparently, according to its website, was established in Germany in 2010, but there's no such German address attached to it. The addresses and the telephone numbers for Al Majid on the website are in Jerusalem, and that throughout the process of arranging these flights, Terence, the Palestinians had only a single telephone number and a contact person. That person can since not be reached. It is alleged that the person from Al Majid tried to get in touch with a lady named Naima Gina, a senior researcher of the Mangubia Institute for Strategic Reflection, because they had accommodated the refugees who had arrived on the flights of the 20th, and that this person from Al Majid had contacted this late Miss Gina to find out what position she held in government. We've had statements issued by the Home Affairs Minister, as well as the President, who's called for an investigation into this. Terence, in our earlier meeting today, our weekly Monday meetings, there were quite some interesting theories that were shared about the origins, the what, the who, the why behind this trip, and who organized it, what for what purpose. But today we want to hear your processing this and how you're making sense of this trip.
Look, I love a good conspiracy theory, And I don't think that there's much to go that's gone on in South Africa that could spark it quite like this has. You have a plane load of people who just seem to materialize out of thin air and show up on the tarmac in OR Tambo. Nobody seems to know where they came from, who sent them here, where they're supposed to be going. And this is as a children's book once said, curiouser and curiouser. Look, my there are all sorts of conjectures that one can throw around. I mean, is this part of the plan to depopulate Gaza? Well, they apparently flew from an Israeli base, although apparently if you're flying out of Gaza, that's where you fly you fly from, because Israel sort of keeps that hold. It also seems somewhat seems like a somewhat weak effort, to think that sending 100 people at a time is going to depopulate any significant part of Gaza. One could speculate: is this some sort of ploy on behalf of people in Durko or the political establishment that really wants to make a statement about South Africa hosting their Palestinian brothers? One option which hasn't been discussed at all is maybe they've been scammed. Maybe this Albert isn't a legitimate actor, but is not particularly mixed up with anyone, because these seats on this flight apparently didn't come free. Nevertheless, what strikes me as interesting is that this isn't like driving your minibus taxi and parking 100 meters away from the Union buildings. This is, flying an airplane, across borders, landing in the busiest airport in the country. This is something that leaves a voluminous paper trail behind. Somebody needs to know something, and I think the first question is, who authorized the flight into South Africa? That should be a relatively easy thing to find out. Then you can start tracing back, who approved this. We've also seen reports about how some of these unfortunate people apparently showed up in Joburg thinking that they were going to Indonesia and Malaysia. Okay, they're only an Indian Ocean away from that. Some apparently have onward flights to Australia and Canada. Which just seem, well, it seems to me if you're going to Canada, you're probably traveling in the wrong direction. So this is crazy. The suggestion that perhaps Israel was trying to embarrass South Africa. I'm not sure that to me that doesn't hold much water, because it would just seem that the Israelis would be handing South Africa a big propaganda coup, that you would actually have genuine live refugees from Gaza to sort of parade around, for the cameras. So I'm at a loss. This is a really, really strange thing. And this, we live in Mzansi. It's difficult to find strange things that can still surprise. Our entire public life seems to be a theater of the bizarre sometimes. But this, there are so many conflicting stories. We're not even sure who the We're not even sure that these people are going to be able to remain in the country. I would just say, as a sort of humanitarian matter, I really don't understand why they were kept on the plane for 8 hours. Surely you can take people off and put them in a waiting room or something, and without clearing them through passport control. But evidently not. Anyway, as As I understand it, the person who could probably resolve this is the Minister of Transport, which is also an interesting thing. This is just doesn't appear to have been to have featured in this. Been a lot of talk about the Minister of Home Affairs, and another theory that I've heard bandied about is that this was a deliberate ploy to embarrass the DA Minister of Home Affairs. You know, that Palestinians were being kept out of the warm embrace of their South African comrades, but he seemed to be as floored by this as anyone else. And it was the officials at the airport who said, you know, you don't have the documents. It's bizarre. I do hope though that we can resolve this, and you know, these people can be fairly adjudicated. And certainly those who actually have family or, you know, onward destinations should be expeditiously helped to get there. I know there is a large Palestinian population in Canada, so presumably these are people who are going to join family there, and I'd imagine they'd be far happier. I did see that one of the refugees referred to South Africa as a land of what was it? Peace, freedom, and laws. I'm not sure about the peace, you know, maybe compared to Gaza, but that's a very low bar. And laws sometimes.
Indeed. I wanted to look here at the South African government's response to this because we're learning that this is the third flight to arrive on South African borders in a matter of a month. And all these flights are sort of unaccounted for in terms of how these people were sent to South Africa. I read multiple versions of the story where it is alleged that, you know, the Israeli forces, before letting them embark on the flight, removed their possessions and sent them without anything, bags, toiletries, clothing. This was reported in the Daily Maverick as well. But also that the government has still not been able to ascertain how flights full of people can just dock in South Africa, and nobody knows anything. Derko in the Daily Maverick article seems to have been caught flat-footed. They heard through the it seems they heard through the grapevines, like most of us did. So did BMA. But as you say, Terence, it's hard to imagine how it is possible that like such a big operation can take place without there being a single document accounting for at least one of those 153 people aboard the flights.
Yeah, look, I spoke to a pilot about this, and he just says crossing a border, there is a mountain of paperwork. There are permissions you have to get, and as I say, this isn't you know docking your minibus, you know, outside of Shebeen and Hillbrow, or you know landing a little Cessna in a bush airstrip. This is like, you know, a charter flight landing in South Africa's premier airport. And wanting to
And
come in, yeah.
their
This
admission
was the
statement
Zimbabwean border. This was this, you
was
know, this was
there. Oh. Banana Republic, as people like to remind us, that this specifically strikes of one such banana republic. But the Minister of Home Affairs says that most of them were admitted into the country as tourists rather than refugees. And I think that's where you see that the 23 of them who then caught on connecting flights to Australia and Egypt. So, and I think the BMA, it was a B, I'm not sure from which authority, I believe it was BMA, who said they've since disappeared into the country. Nobody can account for any of them. I feel for those individuals. I mean, I imagine even though they were escaping, and it is re reported here that they thought they were leaving temporarily. But
Yeah.
obviously, these are one-way flight tickets, right? I'm not sure how temporary it will be in the intermediate period, but that they've now been dumped on foreign soil where language barrier apparently also seems to be an issue when they were trying to communicate with them while they were on the plane, which is something that they plan to do differently from the first two planes of the 20th and the 28th, is that this is apparently what, as reported by Daily Maverick, that the reason they kept them on one of the reasons they kept them on the aircraft was to actually determine why, who how they came about into South Africa, which is something that they hadn't done with the earlier or previous flights. But yeah, on just a human level, I imagine it must be quite a bewildering experience. Yes, to be away from the war, but also to be in a country that you have absolutely no relationship with. That it's not clear when or if you ever go back home. When Daily Maverick describes the people that were sent here, it says they look like business people and professionals. So,
yeah, look, the interesting thing that caught my eye was that this was the apparent price of those seats. You're talking several thousand US dollars. So mm-hmm. these are not, you know, these are not the wretched of the earth. You know, it take considerable resources to actually get on that plane. And also presumably they would have had travel documents, which also is kind of a marker of people who at least have some sort of mobility or resources. So yeah, you know, these strike me as the kind of people who in that society would have had options. And as I say, look, I agree with you 100% on a human level. This is dreadful. And I do understand though that in terms of this peace plan that President Trump mediated, there was provision for Gazans to leave the territory if they so chose. Presumably that is what these people did, and I imagine that's also probably why they would have flown from an Israeli military base, because as I say, Israel isn't simply opening its borders and saying, you know, go to Tel Aviv International Airport or whatever. You're going to be streamed through a particular route. My fear is that this did amount to some sort of human trafficking, you know, or maybe it's a act of humanitarianism, but just so ineptly organized that this is the consequence. And I do hope they get to the bottom of this. If only because it is such a curious and, dare I say it, intriguing situation.
Yeah, no, if there were a dozen flight requests of this nature, I think we should get to the bottom of it, at least because there are people's lives also.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And start with finding out who approved it. That's mm-hmm. the first thing.
From your lips to Durko's ears. Let's move on to the second story. Business Live here is reporting about an exemption that we received from the infamous U.S. tariffs. The title reads, SA Oranges Regain Edge in U.S. Market After Tariff Cut. The South African agriculture sector has welcomed U.S. President Donald Trump signing off an executive order allowing a range of food products to be exempt from his punitive tariff regime. The Trump administration said goods including oranges, bananas, mangoes, coconuts, avocados, and tomatoes could not be produced in sufficient quantities domestically. The global decision saw Trump exempting most of South Africa's citrus and tropical fruits from the recent 30% import tariffs, with the executive order issued on Friday providing much needed relief. The response from one of the citrus organizations in South Africa has been as follows, that supply steadiness is not a luxury, it's a vital hedge against volatility for the American citrus industry and an example of how global trade benefits everyday American consumers. This was the chair of the CGA, a citrus grower, Gerrit van der Merwe, and he says that this announcement takes some pressure off our community. There will be big smiles. I read with a big smile. And so on the farm come Monday morning, because they've been deeply concerned about the future of their valley for many months. Terrence, God forbid Americans not be able to have avocado toast There would be a riot to the levels of Jan 6, I presume. What do you make of this?
Interestingly, I imagine the people who have a particular fondness for avocado toast didn't vote for Trump, but that's by the byway.
Parents, don't forget, Make America Healthy Again.
Of course, yes. Oh, okay, I stand corrected. I understand President Trump himself rather likes orange juice, so maybe that's the force at play. But seriously, the tariffs, I think that we can say we at the Daily Friend are not big fans of tariffs. We like it when people trade. And this implicitly acknowledges the critique by saying that America doesn't actually have the capacity to produce all of these things at all times. We do, so well, let's do a deal. I think, there's something else that strikes me that he and his administration have shown a lot of concern about the plight of South African farmers. But one of the primary sort of targets of the of those tariffs are farmers. Now, as things that aren't covered, like grapes and wine, those hit some of our most high value farming operations. And also disproportionately in the Western Cape, which is the one part of the country that is not that's not under the ANC. My strategic concern, if I was an American, is to wonder, to what extent are these things, are these measures shifting, negatively shifting views in South Africa by people and constituencies whose view of America is not intrinsically hostile. In a way, I don't think that anything that Trump or any other American can do is going to shift anything in the ANC, because I've read ANC documents going back to, well, go back into its time in exile, and the palpable loathing for America sort of seeps out of almost every pore. But I don't think that the average ANC voter sees things in those terms. In fact, I don't think average ANC member even sees things in those terms. You ask, where would you rather go on holiday, New York or Havana? I think that it's probably going to lean very much towards option number one. And if it's like, New York versus Moscow, I think even more heavily. There's a certain kind of, call it cultural or ideological tourist, who'll choose option two, but I think that is a that let's say it's a niche destination. Besides, you can always get good Durko to pay for it. I hope we'll see more of this. Unfortunately, I'm not overly confident in the ability of the South African government at this point to cut a deal, and I'm also not optimistic about President Trump's administration's willingness to do so. And I think that will be to the detriment of both sides. But for now, I do hope that Americans enjoying a nice, refreshing glass of orange juice, made from oat spun, will think of us down here in the southern tip of Africa.
Yeah, I must say, Terence, I also found it to be such a low-hanging fruit argument to look around what Americans consume in June and to say, well, we already provide these produce to them. And so pitch the idea of an exemption to President Trump based on that. Doesn't seem like this idea, it seems like it was unilaterally developed by Trump's administration rather than, through negotiation with South African dignitaries.
Well, I do know that this has been bounced around for quite some time. So the complementarity argument has been there. I just wonder if it only kind of started to resonate when, oh yes, well, this is what happens, isn't it? Sort of on Trump's side. Perhaps you're talking about a situation like, telling a toddler, no, don't put your finger in the in the plug in the wall, and eventually just put it in and see what happens. And it's like, okay, no, that wasn't so much fun. So, you know, maybe this is, look, back in about 2015, I wrote a piece where I said that there was a lot of enthusiasm for Donald Trump as the next president of America because of his business background. Same time, actually, was when Herman Mashaba was standing, and also this was people saying about Cyril Ramaphosa, who was at that stage, I think, the deputy president. Something for which he's never taken full responsibility, just saying. The point is that being a business person uses a different skill set. You're able to get things done in a way you can't do as a politician. And I think this is why those skills don't transfer automatically. Some people can, you know, do well in both, but I think that's because they've developed two distinct sets of skills. But a good politician is doing things in, you know, this in a certain way. A good businessman is doing things, or businesswoman, mustn't forget, is doing things in another way.
Yeah, I think after the first Trump presidency, he's now like well endowed in all things being a politician. I think he's faced as many challenges as one could envision.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Presidency, to fully inculcate.
Yeah, but you still don't know what the kind of outcome of something like a tariff regime. Well, you know, it's not necessarily going to work as it might if you were a businessman able to set those terms in the interests of your own business. A country is a very different beast from a company.
Yeah, I think they also fear the horror of American summer rolling around and, you know, bananas costing like what, $3 per banana or something scandalous like that. I think that would not bode very well for the Trump administration, which has been so hyper focused on reducing inflation, has neglected that, you know, tariff creeps into the prices of goods as inflation does. But yeah, let's close with our last story for today, where the South African municipal workers have been, as this article puts it, blackmailing the city of Johannesburg using the G20 as leverage. So it's the Workers for Billion G20 blackmail. After facing threats of protest and a G20 shutdown by the South African Municipal Workers Union, SAMU, representatives have said they'll close down all the freeways. The Joburg mayor, Dada Morero, and SAMU have finally reached a deal that will see Johannesburg municipal workers paid the same rate as those in other metros. The alleged threats emerged from SAMU's Johannesburg regional chair, Esther Datiana, who said in a widely circulated videos, open quote, "If workers' demands are not resolved, there is no G20 that will take place. If the employer does not resolve this issue on the eve of G20, comrades, we will close down all the freeways and all the entrances and exits. Nothing will move in Gauteng." Closed quotes. So what did the city of Johannesburg do in response? They quietly diverted 4 billion rands of its capital expenditure budget to, as Sunday Times alleges, spare the city of embarrassment of aggrieved workers disrupting this week's G20 summit in the full glare of international publicity. It is being claimed that the divergence of this 4 billion rand in capital expenditure is from entities such as Johannesburg Water and Johannesburg Roads Agency, although it is not clear how much of that 4 billion rand can be traced to these entities. But that 4 billion is apparently set to ensure that SAMU cooperates in a glitch-free summit. Well, it is set to ensure that because the deal has already been struck. To give credence to the workers, and you can comment on this, Terrence, protest, it's the idea that the Johannesburg workers are being paid at a grade 8 level instead of a grade 10 level, where, you know, counterparts like the city of Tshwane are being paid. The deal was finalized on Friday. There's comments here from a governance expert and the DA's City of Johannesburg caucus leader, Belinda Zuo-Njoku. I'll read her comments. And she said that the city had seen water-related protests across the city. And now that there had been a diversion of funds and has now resorted to diverting funds from water infrastructure budgets to save face for the G20. She called it a crisis that is as a direct result of poor prioritization and financial management. Terence, it seems that the city's priority is not to restore water to its residents. It has, I think, more shorter-term goals that it would like to place greater and pay greater attention to. What do you make of this?
Well, I'm going to tell everyone a little secret. The government of this country often takes a lot more takes a lot more notice when well-heeled foreign dignitaries are in the country. Now, I'd also like to say, and this is an interesting one. Forget solidarity, forget the Purple Square movement, forget the Institute of Race Relations. With friends like these, I call solidarity, and it was put up banners. These are guys saying that like they're gonna block roads. This is 1980s stuff, and there were Caspers driving around at that time. No, there's a word for this. It's called extortion. It's saying give us what we want, or we'll embarrass you. We'll make sure that your foreign homies actually know that South Africa is in a deep crisis, and they spend all this time, filling up potholes along selected routes and everything. But when it gets to the question of the city's priorities, just think about it like this. I said earlier that a business person and a politician have different incentive structures. Well, one thing a politician needs to be familiar with is administration. And these are people thinking entirely in political terms, not administrative ones. Johannesburg's infrastructure is sort of teetering on a knife edge. Yesterday, the suburb I live in was without electricity for about 8 hours. Just around about 8 o'clock, the lights flickered and then they were off. And that is not entirely unusual. We have I wouldn't say regular, but let me say not irregular water outages. The city was not built to accommodate this greater population in the density it's in. So you have things like water pipes that are just not designed for the pressure, being forced to carry that burden, and then they, do what structures do when they're subjected to too much pressure. They burst. We went from load shedding to load reduction and sometimes load absence. I do think something could be said to the unionists. You can have services, or you can have sort of un This kind of freewheeling, politically extortionate unprofessionalism. You can't have both. And I think there is something, particularly for the ANC, to say, well, what are you? Are you a political party, that occupies government offices, as a matter of convenience, or are you actually a party that occupies governance in order to, well, govern something? And let's just say that there are parts of Joburg which are seriously in ungoverned spaces. But I doubt very much that the Chinese delegation will be driving through Hillbrow.
If they'll be driving through at all.
Look, I suppose that it'd be quite interesting to see SAMWU blocking the path and right next to a sign saying South Africa, welcome to the most race-regulated society in the world. And Operation Dudula will also be protesting. Pretty much protesting everything. They say the foreigners must know our pain. Well, I understand Operation Dudula can inflict a bit of pain in itself when it chooses to.
I think summer is even more lethal because, they'll have dustbins dumped out into the roads and the paths that these G20 dignitaries are meant to be driving through. And I think that's what gives them greater leverage than, the protest that's due to take place over the abuse of women and children. But yeah, I think they're giving people ideas about exactly how to use their different leverage against the government.
Absolutely.
We'll call it for today. Thank you for joining. That was it from myself and Terence Corrigan. The show will continue as normal whilst Nicholas is away. But tomorrow, same time, same place, there'll be another episode waiting for you. So we hope to see you there. Thank you very much. And that's a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.